Welcome to CougarCast with Keith Schertz and Tosh McIntosh. CougarCast, covering BYU football and basketball. Email the show, cougarcast@gmail.com, and follow on Twitter at CougarCast.
Follow us on Twitter at CougarCast. Please leave us a rating on iTunes. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about BYU basketball and actually want to talk a little bit about BYU football, and we'll save that to the end. So the Cougars, 22-8, they're heading into their last regular season game. And a lot of people may say, well, there's not all that much on the line for this last game. But let me give you reasons why the game versus Gonzaga Saturday does matter. Number one, you can knock Gonzaga out of a West Coast Conference championship. That's huge. Who wants to see the Bulldogs win the West Coast Conference again in a down season? Sure, they were the number nine team in the preseason polls, and they've lost Tarnowski this year. But in a year that you can get Gonzaga, you know, now is the time for them to not win the conference title. If they win in a down year, that's a huge, huge deal in my mind. Number two, if you beat Gonzaga, BYU becomes the 2 seed while Gonzaga becomes the 3 seed. This is particularly important because it allows BYU the opportunity as the 2 seed to not play the Saturday afternoon game and open up the tournament. BYU has been really bad in Saturday afternoon games this year. You should be terrified of Saturday afternoon games. And the other part of this is that if they're a 2 seed, they will play the 7 seed. In the tournament, or if they're a 3 seed, they get the 6 seed. That'll either be Portland or Santa Clara, and it probably means if you're the 2 seed, you probably are going to get Portland, and if you are the 3 seed, you probably get Santa Clara. BYU would rather play Santa Clara. Portland's actually beaten us in 3 of the last 4 halves that we've played against them this year, so... We had a great first half on Thursday night, really beat up on Portland. But they actually beat us in the second half of that game, and they won both the first and second half when we were up at their place earlier in the season. So Portland, kind of a tough team for BYU for whatever reason. BYU got in a roll there in the first half and kind of put the game out of reach. I'd rather see Santa Clara because we've beaten them by 30-plus points in both appearances against them. So we'll be paying attention to that. I hope you'll be paying attention to that. Right now, just so you know, if they end up with the same regular season record, Santa Clara holds the tiebreaker over Portland. They went 2-0 against the Pilots this year. Number three reason, right, besides conference tournament seeding, if we beat Gonzaga, there's the outside chance that the 5th place team in the conference can beat St. Mary's. That would be San Francisco. If San Francisco can beat St. Mary's, the next thing you know, BYU, Gonzaga, and St. Mary's are co-conference champions. And so we're rooting for that. So the Cougars can't make that happen if it were to happen without beating Gonzaga. So they got to beat Gonzaga. It's another big one. And then this is the next one that I want to talk about. The 4th point that I want to make is that if BYU beats Gonzaga, it would be pretty impossible to give the Conference Player of the Year award to Kyle Wilcher. And Kyle Collinsworth will be the Conference Player of the Year. The conference only one time in the last 20 years has awarded a player on a team outside of the top 2 in the final West Coast Conference standings, the West Coast Conference Player of the Year. If they could make it so that Gonzaga would be tied in a three-way tie with being third in that tiebreaker with losing twice to BYU, I just don't see the voters, how they find a way to give the award to Kyle Wiltshire. Conversely, if Kyle Wiltshire can come in and win the road game and finish higher in the standings than Kyle Collinsworth and have a good performance, whatever player has the better performance and whose team wins, I think that player will probably be named West Coast Conference Player of the Year. It's an important thing kind of for Kyle Collinsworth's legacy, the all-time assist leader and rebounds leader in the history of BYU. Has every accolade coming to him. 11 triple-doubles in his career. The guy has been outstanding, and he'd be the first BYU legend to kind of not win a West Coast Conference, not be named the Conference Player of the Year. Like Chesmer Kosich, he was never given Conference Player of the Year, but that's because they didn't give it out. The WAC Conference didn't give it out. The first year that the WAC gave out a Conference Player of the Year was in 1980. Okay, and then number five, the Cougars are 22-8 on the season. In our preseason preview for the season, I predicted the BYU would have 23 wins with 8 losses. So there you go. That's the other reason they need to win, because I want to nail that prediction. That would be pretty awesome. Beating Gonzaga is going to be difficult. Gonzaga has been playing very good basketball as of late. They dropped a game last Saturday to St. Mary's. They don't lose 2 out of 3 games all that often. This is a very difficult team. Obviously, Mark Few's club, very well coached. They play well. And if you're feeling confident because, hey, BYU beat Gonzaga the first time they played, and so you're feeling really confident about BYU's chances, simply because we got a 1-point victory in Spokane last time, let me tell you that you can feel good about that, and that's great. BYU's a vastly different team now. What BYU attempts to do as a basketball team now, the identity that they have found and the things that they do to try to win basketball games has completely changed since we played Gonzaga. In fact, it's been since we lost to Pacific at home. If you've been reading and following me on Vanquish the Foe, reading my articles about the basketball team, you will know that I wrote an article about the plus-minus statistic as it relates to the lineups that Dave Rose was playing. In particular, his starting lineup. At the time, he was playing Kyle Collinsworth, Chase Fisher, Nick Emery, Kyle Davis, and Nate Austin. This group had played at least 60 minutes more than the next lineup with the most minutes. It was by far Dave Rose's preferred lineup, and it was a bad lineup. That group of five players, for whatever reason, did not mesh. That group of five, again, Collinsworth, Fisher, Emery, Davis, and Austin. In fact, they were minus 29 over their last 6 games that they actually played together. So I published an article talking about how bad that team is, that lineup is. How they always get beat, that it doesn't matter who they're playing. It can be Santa Clara, it could be anybody, and they're going to end up giving you losing minutes. The other team's going to score more points when that group is on the floor. So I had been tracking that, and if you haven't seen the article, I suggest you go to Vanquish the Foe, look up, just Google, whatever you need to do, why BYU changed its starting lineup. Give it a read, look at some of the numbers. But I suggest in that to never, it was after the Pacific game, never play that lineup again. Don't play your favorite, most preferred lineup that you've played 50 or 60 minutes more than the next most preferred lineup. a really strange thing happened. That group of five players hasn't been on the floor together since that article was released. So I'm either just like really super lucky, or somebody saw it. Let's go with lucky. Let's go with lucky for a minute. Okay. The next thing that I suggest is that Dave Rose was allowing other teams to dictate his lineups too much. That he did not need to make adjustments based upon the personnel that Pacific was putting out on the floor. That was not a way to play basketball for BYU. BYU couldn't concern itself with the decisions that Pacific was making on the floor. Rather, what they needed to do is just put out their five guys that were going to play best. I used the plus-minus statistic again in terms of lineups, which is a really good metric. Plus-minus individually gives you a good idea of trends, but it's not super reliable because it doesn't account for the contributions that the player made individually. That you could get a lot of credit for things that your teammate's doing. So you could put old Keith Schertz out on the floor, and if Chase Fisher hits 5 3-pointers, and I just do nothing and stand in the corner, and then I get checked out of the game, that's a plus 15 for me. Wow, he's playing really great. So there's problems with it individually, but lineups over time, this is a pretty strong metric. So I made the really strong suggestion that BYU ought to start looking to go small. And the reason was when they were playing small, and specifically with Zach Seljaas playing the four, when they did that, BYU was winning. Teams didn't know how to handle that many shooters and that many scoring threats. And so because of that, BYU had a strong advantage. For whatever reason, those four players, whenever you have four guards out there, and I'm including Seljaas as a guard, or maybe if you want to talk about it as a stretch four, BYU's going to win. That's going to be a strong thing that'll happen for you. And I even suggested that Chapman could play more minutes. He could go at the four. And you could also continue to build upon using Jacob Hartsock. So since that article was released, 76.6%, right, of the 200 minutes BYU has played since that article was released during their five-game win streak since losing to Pacific, in those 200 minutes, 153 of them have been played with small ball lineups. 76.6% of the time, BYU is going to have three guards, a wing, and then a big guy. And it's working. It's actually destroying. It's doing really great. Small ball lineups with Zach Seljaas at the four are plus 61 over the last four games. That's over 106 minutes worth of time. That's amazing. Plus 61. Small ball lineups with Jordan Chapman playing the four, plus 14. That's over a 20-minute period. So Chapman, this is plus 14. This is during the last five games. When they play with Jacob Hartsock at the four, BYU is plus 28 during that time. So again, with those three players at the four, it's been either Hartsock, Chapman, or Seljaas, and they have played 153 of BYU's 200 minutes in the last five games. And they are a combined, right, 103. They're plus 103 with those guys on the floor. Now, some of this is inflated because of the 58-point butt-kicking of San Diego. At the same time, we had a two-point win at San Diego. So between those two, it feels about right. BYU's are probably more around 30 points better than San Diego. So I decided to not worry about those huge influxes within the numbers because I felt like the same team they played twice, it was so, imbalanced that may even it out. Regardless of whether it evens out or not, it doesn't change the fact that Dave Rose is playing small ball and he's going small and it's working, okay? BYU is plus 103 in the last five games when they're going small. They've only played non-small ball lineups, like their starting lineup. The current starters are Collinsworth, Fisher, Emery, Davis, and Kafusi. And that's been a much better starting lineup, much better starting lineup than the one that they were using before. Instead of Kafusi, they're playing Austin. Kafusi in the starting lineup, and Kafusi and Davis play really well together. Austin and Davis do not play well together. But what we've found is when they've gone non-small ball, they've only done that for 28 of the 200 minutes. And then, of course, there's another 19 minutes or so, just a little under 19 minutes of just garbage time, like Davin Gwynn takes over time. So you have just 29 minutes of non-small ball where you got two posts, two guys that are going to try to work on the block and try to post up and score that way. When BYU has two of those guys on the floor, we've only played that way for 28 minutes over the last five games. That's just 14.1% of all the minutes that BYU could potentially be using on the floor. BYU's only going with two posts for a short period of time of that. Over the last five games, they're plus 30 in the non-small ball category. So they're still playing well in that. In fact, playing very well. They're getting over a point a minute advantage over their opponents when they're non-small ball. So that's pretty awesome. And who they've played obviously factors in to the robust plus-minus numbers, but you've seen that BYU has been playing their best style of basketball that they've played all year. The ball's moving well. A lot of guys are scoring. You know, I think five, six, maybe even seven guys were in double figures against Portland last evening. So BYU is playing its best ball of the year, and it's by going with this small ball, or as David Locke, he's the play-by-play voice of the Utah Jazz, he likes to call it skill ball. Well, you're just playing your best players on the floor. So who's the best big man to play? So small ball works for BYU. Who's the best big man to play with these small ball lineups? Again, small ball, just our three guards like usual, and then at the four, either Hartsock, Chapman, or Celius. So big man, all right? Davis with the small ball guys has seen the most minutes. He's been in there for 73 minutes. BYU's plus 46 with Kyle Davis in a small ball. Nate Austin with small ball has played the least amount of minutes, 27 minutes, but they're plus 37 with Nate Austin. That's a tremendous number. Nate Austin's hustle and offensive rebounding, I'm going to assume that that's kind of the difference, that he creates more offensive possessions with those offensive rebounds, and it gives them an opportunity to be to maximize their opportunity and to score more and to get more shots up. Because again, if you're out there with Fisher, Collinsworth, Emery, and say Celius, you've got guys that can score and can shoot. And so a guy like Austin creating more opportunities for BYU to score by crashing the offensive boards or finding a loose ball or diving and getting to that, that's really valuable with this group of players. So like I said, 37, they're plus 37 in the 27 minutes that Nate Austin's had an opportunity to play with them over the last five. Corbin Kafusi's been on the floor for 44 minutes with the small ball group, and they're plus 21. So none of these guys are doing poorly. They're all playing well. The small ball group's good. And whoever the big is with them, it's really nice. This tactic is so different, so vastly different than the way they were playing when they played earlier in the season. In fact, we haven't really discovered this type of play until late in the year. So it'll be interesting to see what Dave Rose elects to do against Gonzaga. Before I talk about Gonzaga and how it relates to small ball, let me just first say I've had a few people ask me, well, what's happened with Jamal Yates? He's no good. Oh, Dave Rose is going to kick him out of the program. He's going to transfer. He's going to... So a couple things I want to just mention about Jamal Yates. Number one, not every freshman or sophomore is going to be ready to contribute. Anson Winder wasn't ready to play and to really contribute and play big minutes and be a guy until he was a senior. Not everyone's going to do that, okay? Nick Emery coming in and playing right away. Celius coming in and playing right away. These things are unusual. Jamal Yates being on the floor, if you play Jamal Yates, he's an undersized four. He can't shoot the three, so he doesn't stretch the floor. He just doesn't fit what they're trying to do as a team at this point. So I'm sorry, Jamal Yates, that's not working. And that doesn't mean, just because we're playing the small ball style right now, this year, does not mean that in future years, next year or the following year, that BYU will not change the way it is. Part of what makes small ball work is the fact that you've got the best rebounder in the history of school as your point guard. Well, he's going to be gone next year. So within the current complexion of this team, there's just no way to justify saying, oh, well, we don't need that guy, right? Hopefully he understands this and he'll work his way into the system, because it's not going to stay this way forever. So that's my take on Jamal Yates. He's a good player. I don't want him to go. I think he can really add to the Cougars in the future years. Yes, even with all the talent that's coming in, people think that everyone's just going to jump in front. Like, you know, Jamal Yates is just so not good that anybody can just join the program and be better than him. I don't buy it. Will he ever be a star? I don't know. Can he be valuable to this team in the future? Absolutely. So I made the suggestion, go small, in that article. Why BYU changed his starting lineup. I criticized Dave Rose for not going small. He should have went small against Pacific. We probably don't lose to Pacific if he does it. He didn't do it. And then BYU plays 76% of their minutes from then on going small. So in the article I said, don't play Nate Austin and Kyle Davis together along with the three guards. It hasn't happened since that article. I said, go small. 76% of the time, they're going small. I said, play Jordan Chapman more in that article. Jordan Chapman's playing the most minutes per game over the last five games than he has all season. I'm either the luckiest guy in the world, right? Or somebody's reading Vanquish the Foe. There's too many coincidences, right? Somebody read this thing. It's more fun for me to think that. So the problem is now you've got Gonzaga. Gonzaga is very skilled on the inside. Their guards are decent, but they're not that great this year. In fact, that's the big problem with the Gonzaga roster, is that, you know, they're in a transition year when it comes to their guards. Dranguinis is okay. He usually plays he's kind of a small forward. He's 6'5". He's a decent player, but between McClellan, he hasn't, you know, done everything they needed him to be. Josh Perkins has been another guard, the freshman for them. He's been pretty good, 10 points a game. But their guard line is okay. The problem is that when you play Gonzaga, they've got, obviously, Kyle Wilcher, the 6'10 senior. He scores. He's a stretch guy. He gets you 20.8 per game. He's going to get 6.4 rebounds a game. He's a decent passer. Even more scary is Domantas Sabonis. Sabonis, 6'10", right? 230. The Lithuanian, 17.3 points per game, 11.8 rebounds per game. I mean, 17 and 12 is ridiculous. I mean, that's what he's averaging this year. By the way, he was in foul trouble for that entire first game. Like, I think he missed 10 plus minutes in the first half, and he got his fourth foul with something like 15 minutes left to go. So, you know, Gonzaga was a little bit handicapped the first time around because Sabonis was on the bench. Ryan Edwards, 7'1", 294 pounds. He was decent. He got a few buckets, made a couple free throws against the Cougars in their first outing. So they've got bigs. They've got a lot of bigs. And then, you know, you add some of the toughness of Drank Guinness. But, you know, Kyle Wiltshire, Ryan Edwards, Domantas Sabonis, those three guys, any combo of those three guys makes it difficult for BYU to play Zach Seljaas at the four. The problem is the majority of Gonzaga's minutes come with at least two of those three players, Edwards, Wiltshire, Sabonis. Two of those three players are going to be on the floor for Gonzaga. And I don't know that you can play small ball against those guys. I was saying against guys like Pacific and, you know, when you go and play Portland or whoever else, BYU should dictate who they want on the floor and just make the other teams worry about it. Against Gonzaga, you do have to do some game planning here. And I really don't feel all that comfortable going small. I'm certain that the Cougars will do it at some points, but there's a very strong chance that that's going to not go well. Wiltshire, Sabonis are going to... one of those two guys is going to be guarded in the post by Zach Seljaas. Kyle Davis guarding them in the post. Now, their defense has gotten better, BYU. Nobody's really talking about that. BYU's defense is a lot better. Okay, they're playing with an intensity and effort. They're understanding things. They're forcing problems out on the perimeter. Any lazy passes out in that perimeter are getting picked off. Nick Emery is getting that Jackson Emery knack of jumping passing lanes. Right, Kyle Collinsworth is stealing more basketballs at the top of the key than I can remember him ever doing. And this is kind of a new development, is that St. Mary's game. And since then, it's continued to be really good. Over the last seven games, it's kind of a newer development. Even though he stole a lot of passes, this business of the steal and having the breakaway dunk, that's kind of a new wrinkle. But I don't know that BYU can continue to employ the small ball. And I don't think they can play 30 of the 40 minutes with small ball. Not against Gonzaga. Their personnel won't allow BYU to do it. So it's a problem. Austin and Davis playing together, that makes me a little concerned. Okay, they tend not to do very well. The only time the two of them do well together is when Kyle Collinsworth is off the floor. Whenever Nick Emery or Jordan Chapman are running the point and you play Davis and Austin together, it tends to be a nice lineup. It seems to work. But if you have those two guys who want to work kind of on the blocks and be in the inside and be tough in there, and then you're going to have Collinsworth crashing the boards and you're going to have him driving the lane and trying to score that way. For whatever reason, this is not a good unit. It doesn't really mesh. It doesn't really work together in the way that it needs to work. And I just think that's a bad way to go. So let's hope that Kyle Davis and Corbin Kafusi, that they can work together. A lot of people will not remember this, but there were some foul trouble issues. And the Cougars actually looked to Braden Shaw to eat up some minutes at the end of the first half. He and Jordan Chapman were on the floor, and they actually won during their stretch of time on the floor. They were +4 during that segment, and it was huge. Jamal Ates played key minutes in that game in Spokane. And I think you're going to have to see Shaw, Ates. These guys are going to have to step up and make some plays in order for the Cougars to hang in and do some of the stuff that they're going to want to do against Gonzaga, because I just don't think that they can play the way they've been playing against the Bulldogs. Just don't. Hope I'm wrong, but I think Dave Rose, I hope he understands that this is a different scenario, and that with the personnel lineups that they have for Gonzaga, this is a situation where if it's not going well, he needs to pull the trigger quickly and get away from small ball against Gonzaga. So keep your eye out for that. It's what I'm worried about. I think BYU has a very strong chance to win. I think, like I've said, Gonzaga is very beatable. So I'll predict BYU is going to get them because they're at home. I think Kyle Collinsworth has something to prove. Conference Player of the Year is on the line, and he likes playing with those added things. Like, when he gets close to a triple-double, you could see how competitive and how hard he works. Like, he was 3 rebounds short of the triple-double last night, and I mean, he was crashing the boards so hard. He wanted it badly. He always crashes the boards good, really hard. But he knew maybe his time was going to run out, that Dave Rose was going to bench him. He wasn't going to certainly play the whole game. And, boy, he was working hard to get rebounds. I think if he can take it as a personal challenge, that he's got to outplay, he's got to give this tremendous performance and make it no doubt in the minds of voters who the Conference Player of the Year is. I think those are things that really will help Kyle Collinsworth. Kyle Wiltshire tends to be somebody that, when they have big games and big moments, he's not so good. Now, he was freaking awesome against BYU last time. He was great, and nobody else really was that great. And so, kudos to Kyle Wiltshire. He's a fantastic scorer. I think Kyle Collinsworth's a better player. I think if you called BYU and you're Gonzaga, you said, we'll make the trade. BYU says no. I think Gonzaga says yes. Kyle Collinsworth is 14 rebounds away from joining, and not just joining, sorry, creating the 1,500 career points, 1,000 rebounds, career rebounds, and 500 assist club. Nobody in the history of college basketball has finished their career with 1,500, 1,000, and 500. He's a one-of-a-kind player. The triple doubles, of course, are fantastic, but it's not just the triple doubles. This guy has just produced and produced and produced, and he's been fan freaking tastic. So this is a coaching game. Mark Few is a great coach. I think he's a better coach than Dave Rose. And if Dave Rose doesn't realize quickly that small ball may not work here, and I don't think it will. He's going to have to resort to doing some lineups that were not so great earlier in the year. But he may need to go that way because, you know, they did decent against Gonzaga specifically. But he needs to use bigger lineup against Gonzaga. He just has to. And maybe I'm wrong. Hot shooting can bail a lot of that out. But as these two teams match up, I really worry about the way BYU's playing when it comes to facing a team like Gonzaga. But I'll take the Cougars. I'll trust the hot shooting, and we'll do that. By the way, update on the Nick Emery chase for 112. That is 112 games with at least 10 points. That's Danny Ainge's career record at BYU. It's second all-time in NCAA. We're past the threshold. If Nick Emery doesn't get to 10 points, his chance to reach Danny Ainge's record will be broken. I believe he is 6 games into that stretch. So he's got a very, very long way to go, but it's fun to cheer for. So 10 points a game for Nick Emery. Just always keep an eye on that. Let's see if he can make a run at Ainge. Okay. Now let me talk a little bit about the BYU football team. If you'll remember, just before the Las Vegas Bowl, there was this story that came out that BYU was not going to take an airplane with the team. They weren't going to travel from Provo Airport to Las Vegas by airplane. They were going to take it by bus. And the reason that they chose to take buses rather than airplanes was because these funds were going to be used, the funds that were saved were going to be used to extend the student athlete building, make the weight room bigger for the football team. They were going to improve the weight room, make it bigger. And they were going to be able to do that because they took buses instead of flying. And Bronco Mendenhall shared this story. The price difference, apparently, from chartering a jet to take your team to Las Vegas and to bus your team to Las Vegas, according to Bronco Mendenhall, was $300,000. $300,000 cheaper to bus 120 guys to Las Vegas than it is to fly 120 guys. It's nearly, if that price is correct, and we're adding on a top, we're saying that every time we take a road trip and the team flies, they flew to 5 games last year, that BYU's burning $3,000 a seat per kid to fly on one of these airplanes? The number didn't seem right to me. So if you'll allow me, I think that's junk. It's a bogus story. I just don't believe it. It's a story about being frugal, being wise with your money and frugality and weighing the different benefits of how to use your money and how wise is this team to have taken buses because now they get a weight room. You know, very prudent of them. How frugal. My problem with this is that with that $300,000 quote for how much they saved, that frugality is flying straight into the face of a lack of care for funds. $3,000 a seat is what BYU's paying for guys to travel on airplane for football games. I can fly to London, England. You could see the world for a round trip for $3,000. What are we doing? BYU in their 5 road trips. And by the way, this is just $300,000 to fly an airplane to Las Vegas from Provo. To Las Vegas. $300,000 cheaper. You gotta be kidding me. There's no way. That means at the minimum, BYU last year spent if that number's correct, $1.5 million on airfare. It bothered me. So, I went down the rabbit hole. BYU flies on JetBlue airplanes. JetBlue's fleet that would hold the football team is an A320. It's an Airbus A320. So I looked it up. I found out that you can lease a brand new Airbus for $300,000 a year. It just happened to work out that way. I then found out that between insurance and the cost for gas and for hangar fees and to have just upkeep on the plane and to hire pilots to fly the team 5 times a season, that costs you $500,000. It's $500,000. But since you own your own airplane, you can be busy renting it out to other people to help recover some of the costs. Maybe you can find someone foolish enough to pay $300,000 to rent it for a 1-hour flight. Listen, if they were spending $1.5 million, the director of football operations under Bronco Mendenhall, thank goodness they're gone. Thank goodness they're gone. That's a ridiculous use of funds. And yet, oh, look at us, we're so prudent. Look at us, we're so frugal. We're getting a bigger weight room because we're taking buses. I don't deny that it's cheaper to take buses. I deny that it's $300,000 cheaper. And for heaven's sakes, if they're paying that much for flights, hire me. I'll go buy you an airplane. BYU will have its own airplane. I'll manage that for us. I'll get enough people. I know I'm starting to sound like Donald Trump. I'll get enough people to rent this thing. They'll pay for the airplane for us. BYU will have it for all their home games, and then whenever we don't need it, we just let other people rent the thing. We're done. What are they doing? Well, I know BYU is smarter than me when it comes to running business. I'm certain of it. BYU Athletics has to be better at this. So, there's a reason why we don't own our own airplane. They're not spending $500,000 a year on airfares. If they were spending more, significantly more, $1 million more, they would own their own plane. Why wouldn't you? It's stupid not to. So what it is instead is it's a bunch of garbage. It's just garbage. It's a PR story. Bronco Mendenhall put out numbers specifically. That was stupid of him because it's not true. There's just no way that's true. And if it is true, holy crap, that's really bad. Like, we need Taysom Hill running the business of BYU Athletics more than we need him back on the football field. By the way, I'll wait for Tosh. He and I have opinions on this, but Tanner Mangum should be the starting quarterback. I'll leave it at that for the time being. But for whatever reason, everyone has bought it. Nobody has questioned that number of 300K. But question it, because it's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous amount of money to pay, right? I understand that you're private chartering a flight from Provo to Las Vegas, but there's no way that it costs $3,000 a seat. There's no way. That's an outrageous number. Right? You can fly first class for like $400. I know you're on your own itinerary, your own airfields, but come on. Come on. Anyway, I don't know that it matters. All I know is that it's another sign that I'm kind of glad Bronco's gone, because you continue to hear these stories and things that come up. Things that come up, these were things, you know, there's always these things about, you know, the wonderful values that are being, and that was just garbage. It's just garbage. That's just, that one's 100% untrue. There's no way I'm sorry. Also, one other thing, Bronco had did an interview recently. I don't know if you saw US Today, they did an interview with him. The article is called something like "Why Bronco Left BYU." And essentially he blames independence. He says it's not sustainable, that he had taken it as far as he could go. And that was a real problem for him. But you know what? He was a coach under independence for 5 years. Like, I know that's not what he came into the job for, and that it kind of changed the terms of what his job was like. And so, like, I understand being upset with that. At the same time, he was so positive about it. He never expressed any trepidation. Sure, he said he wanted to get into a Power 5 conference, but he was always, you know, so rah-rah about independence. And then he leaves and he goes and tells everyone how independence is not sustainable and how it's not going to work and how BYU football cannot really be successful and go on as long as they're independent. Cool, man. He also said something cryptic about how something down the stretch of last year changed. That there was a change. And when that change occurred, it became clear, nope, that's not strong enough. Crystal clear that it was time for me to go. I have no idea what changed. It doesn't really seem like anything changed. What seems like what changed, you know, Bronco had applied for other jobs. He tried to go to Wisconsin. He'd been up for the Oregon State job. He had been interviewed at other places and had actively looking for other places. And everyone was passing on him. You know what changed this time? He applied somewhere and they actually said yes. That's what changed. All right. I'm starting to get cranky. Thank you for listening to CougarCast. Email me, cougarcast@gmail.com. I'll be back with Tosh next time. Go Cougars, beat Gonzaga.
Thank you for listening to CougarCast. If you enjoyed this show, take the time out to give us a rating on iTunes. Also, look for us on vanquishthefoe.com. If that isn't enough, you can follow us on Twitter @CougarCast. Enjoy the games and go Cougars.